Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Help! Hello, everyone, and welcome to Real Recovery. Here with the Illusions of Confidence are your hosts, Bill Arnold and George Fraser. George, you know, you were the very reason your parents couldn't have nice things. Do you feel still feel shame?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I'll bring that sentence in for a fitting and have it back
and
for you Wednesday.
This,
no,
dude,
I didn't practice
you?
It. I just wrote it down.
Okay.
I just had that thought.
George, we can never have anything nice.
That's right. It's because of you, isn't it?
Yep. I wreck everything.
Yeah.
And
do you still feel shame?
No. It's kind of my gift, I think. So
really?
You go with it.
Mm-hmm. George, you know, you always help me believe I could do less.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, George, we're going to talk about eating disorders tonight, and we're very excited because we've got a special guest we're going to bring on in just a few minutes, if we get to the point where we have time.
Well, you know, I'm really excited about that.
You know the way
that.
It is with
I know.
Us.
Well, we get on a roll like we are now.
Yeah. It's we're hot right now.
We should have subtitles going with this thing, right? I love talking with people about eating disorders, and the reason for that is I believe that's the hardest one to treat. I'm a recovering alcoholic, cocaine addict, Bill, and you can stop using those substances,
mm-hmm.
but you need to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that would be like having a couple drinks every day, and I'm sure I'd want to go, okay, it's Sunday. I haven't had one all week, and I have 14, you know?
Right.
And so it has to trigger a little bit of a craving in that, you know, you need it to survive. So it's very difficult. And tonight we're on step one. And step one says we admitted we were powerless over drugs, alcohol, food, and that our lives were unmanageable. And I think for me, what I've really been working on the last year is the unmanageability of a life that I'm trying to run without God. And what I mean by that is a lot of my life, I'm trying to make myself happy and satisfied with externals. Food, working out, used to be drugs and drinking, but I can only be satisfied not with externals, but with the eternal. And
mm-hmm.
that's with God living in me. And we have all these God substitutes. And sometimes you need those to survive, like work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you work too much? But the eating disorders, I think, are really hard.
George, you were in the candy business for many, many years. So
yep.
I think the last time I checked, there's a fair amount of sugar in candy. So there must have been some withdrawal from that. And I know you suffered from, instead of having a cookie, you'd want all 14 of them.
Oh, gosh. I went out and had a sundae the other night. And, I got done. And the person I was with says, well, what do you want to do now? It's like, I want to go back and get another sundae. Because what sugar does for me, and I believe, I didn't know this at the time. But, yeah, our family owned a candy company. We made about 50 million pounds of candy a year.
Mm-hmm.
White sugar was my first addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that till I was in my 40s and 20 years sober, that kind of triggers it and it spikes you.
Yeah.
And you know that. I know you're very healthy about what you eat. You eat very clean, and I try to, not anywhere excessively like you do,
mm-hmm.
where there's no enjoyment in anything you
yeah,
eat.
Yeah, but I don't eat Fruit Loops at every meal.
That's Cap'n Crunch.
Yeah. Cap'n Crunch, yeah.
Yeah. But I know when I have something like that, it changes my whole thinking and how I feel. It
mm-hmm.
kind of... it gets you a little bit high.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you wanted the second sundae, did you want it because you were still a little hungry, or just the food, it tasted so good, you just wanted more taste?
It was both, you know.
Yep.
It was kind of like drinking. You got to go up and order another one before you run out. So,
mm-hmm.
but it does trigger, and there's a craving, I think, once you get the sugar in. We had the lady on from Philadelphia who told us that salty snacks and sugar do that, and it's your brain chemistry. Do you remember that?
I do.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a very interesting show. I think what it does, a lot of these things, Bill, it shows us our brokenness before a holy God.
Mm-hmm.
And finding out that you do have an eating disorder or that you're an alcoholic, I'll tell you what, that's not a bad thing. I think the conviction comes from God, the Holy Spirit, that you do have a problem because you've known it.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're willing to do something about it. But also there's a solution.
Yep.
That's going to work. And I think that only can come from God, because otherwise, you know, a dead man doesn't know he's dead.
Yeah. Okay, here's the framework, George, from what I think I understand food addictions. You've got anorexia nervosa, which is inadequate food take leading to a weight that is clearly too low.
All right.
That's
okay.
Just, you're not eating because you have intense fear of weight gain, obsession with weight, and persistent behavior to prevent weight gain. and that has a self-esteem overrelated to body image.
Right. I think the body image, what they see is not the reality. And
of course,
that's part of our sin. We don't see ourselves as children of God either. So there's a tie in there.
No. And then the binge eating disorder would be just a feeling of being out of control during the binge eating episodes. Feelings of strong shame or guilt regarding the binge eating.
Sure.
Okay.
And I think all of us at one point had a little bit of that, Bill, in that we were exercise bulimics. And that before we started eating, well, when we got too old to burn it off through exercise, you know, do you remember the days you'd go out and work out real hard, maybe have a pizza or some cookies afterwards?
Yeah, you could eat a pizza while working out gain weight.
I like that.
Yeah. But you can't compete with what you eat.
I love that.
It's so true. I mean, you really can't go run it off anymore.
Not at our age.
No, not at our age.
You can't even run at our age.
And the other one, Georgie, is bulimia nervosa, which is frequent episodes of consuming large amount of food followed by behaviors to prevent weight gain, such as self-induced vomiting.
Okay, now I have no professional expertise here on this.
Yeah,
I'm a licensed alcohol drug counselor, but I think sometimes they're combined where you can be a bulimorexic. And when our guest comes on, maybe we can discuss that. But this... it changes, I think, over time, and they can combine. But I think it's the hardest one, Bill, to work with.
Because everybody gets up every day and has to eat to survive, and there are so many temptations, and it's really the fastest way to change the way you feel. And there's so many opportunities. I mean, you can go to church, and after church, there's that big table of donuts and things that you go, I shouldn't be eating this, but here I am at church. I'm going to be social and have a donut.
Well, I think in the evangelical community where we're a part of, I'm a Lutheran, so not totally, but...
You're a Lutheran?
Well, it's easier. It's a lot shorter services, you know. And
I wish I would have known this 5 years ago.
Fewer requirements.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. I think the acceptable sin in modern Christianity is obesity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have pie night and stuff like that, and you look around at church, a lot of people are heavy. But yet, you know, that's kind of an acceptable deal.
Mm-hmm. And that would be gluttony, right?
It is for me.
Right.
But I think it's the same thing. I'm trying to get something to satisfy me and fill me up and make me feel okay that's not coming from God.
It's also a little social lubricant, too, if you're nervous and feel a little socially awkward. I mean, it's nice to be eating if you can reduce some of your anxiety in social situations.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like having some kind of drink in your hand.
Well, you had some cocktails and some food. You got it going. And that's usually what we do when we entertain people.
Mm-hmm.
I know you don't drink. I don't drink. We don't have any friends we don't entertain. But, yeah, that's what people do.
Yeah. You're one of my better friends, and I think that's a testimony to just how hard it is for me to make friends.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good reflection on either one of us, actually.
Yeah.
But I think what we want to get to is the powerlessness of this, in that you realize at a certain point, God points out to you that you really can't do anything about it. And if you're honest, you really don't, but you're helpless. And there's people listening tonight, we've been there, you know, where you don't think there's a way out. Well, for you, there isn't. But with God, all things are possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, George, when we look at step one, is it safe to say that we are powerless over sin? Can we just say that?
Yeah,
does
I think
work?
So. It does for me. Mm-hmm. I'm powerless over my next breath. It comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God.
I got that. So
stole that one from John Piper.
Did you?
Yeah.
You know, it's a good one.
He stole it from God.
He does.
Yeah.
He gets all. God has all the good material, doesn't he? So step one is we get to the point where we say, all right, we are powerless over the sin that lives in us, and we have to repent and be set free. And then we have to work out our salvation with fear and trembling.
Absolutely.
And we need fellowship, we need encouragement, and we need wisdom and advice from people like our guests that we're going to bring on the air in just a minute.
I think you need to get all of that and the information from God before you decide to do it. It's the, I don't know, quickening of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're hopeless, and all of a sudden it comes to the thought, maybe you don't have to live this way. Maybe there's a way out. And it's, you know, with... I stole that from John Calvin, probably, but I think that it has to come from God, because people that have problems, all of us, I knew I was a drunk years before I quit drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You're stuck, you know? And so if you're listening tonight and you're stuck, we're going to have some good stuff on this program.
I'm just afraid there's going to be like 100 ping pong balls fall on me, which is what you got from Captain Kangaroo.
I remember that.
Yeah. Remember that?
I wonder what he's doing now.
I don't know. Do you remember that, though, the ping pong ball bombardment? Yeah. I say that.
Who was the guy in Mr. Grandfather Clock?
I don't know.
Is that the same show?
Yeah, it's the same show.
No wonder we're so weird. You know, you got sugared cereal and you got this stuff going on.
Yeah, and we have very few friends. If we didn't have each other, we'd be in trouble.
Hopefully our guest didn't hang up yet.
I think she's still on the line. All right, here's what we should do, George.
Let's go to it, huh?
Let's take just a second break, and then we'll sort of cleanse the palate, and then we'll bring her on.
Smell good.
Yeah, that was kind of good, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, you're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We have Kim from Georgia coming up next. Don't go anywhere. You're in for a big show tonight. Back to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm not a perfect person. Great line, huh, George? I should let it play a little bit longer. It's a good song.
Yeah, it's a new one. It's good. Yeah. Good job.
George, you know it takes years to reach the place where you do comedy well? I hope we reach that someday.
Well, you have.
Thank you. All right, George, let's bring on our guest, Kim from Georgia. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a joy.
Oh, so nice of you to say that. Sounded like you meant it too.
That was a little forced.
It was a little awkward, a little forced, but we'll accept it. We'll accept that as an answer. So you have been willing to come on and talk about some eating issues you've had in your life, and George, where's a good place to start?
Well, I was going to say at the beginning, but that's kind of stupid.
Yeah, that's really stupid.
But I always want to hear, you know, a little background on growing up and if there was God in the life and what kind of kid.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You know, kind of sets the stage.
Sure. Well, the reason my response sounded a little forced, I was listening to your opening. And, I mean, you've pretty much already said it all. You've said everything everyone needs to know. We covered eating for others. We covered getting older and can't exercise it off anymore. There were a lot. You covered a lot.
We didn't intend to do that.
Gluttony. I mean, you were so. I grew up in a Christian home, although. I didn't connect the dots on this until both of my parents were deceased, which happened 7 or 8 years ago. And they were divided. They weren't of one accord. And they married at a time when, you know, one church or the other wouldn't allow you to maintain your membership if you married outside of it. And so my mom saw to it that we got to, you know, our religious education, but mom and dad weren't in church together. So it didn't really stick. And the teaching in, you know, for my young mind, it didn't include grace. So my takeaway as a young adult was, well, there's a God, but he's really mad and I've sinned and I'm really in trouble. So I'm just going to try to avoid him. I'm going to try to stay, you know, I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to try to, there's no point in trying to please God because I'm not that good. So that was my religious framework as a young adult. And you can only imagine the fun and games that set me up for in life.
Oh, boy. So you think he's angry at you?
I did. That was my concept. That God is mad and you're going to get it. And so, you know, try to hide.
Yeah.
Try to hide from it or avoid. And that avoidance is really key with the eating because, you know, my parents divorced. That's a big, big part of the story that I think we tend to discount because our culture says that it's normal and our culture says kids are resilient and all these things. But, you know, there was alcohol abuse in the home and there was rageaholic stuff. And then there was also a lot of perfectionism and performance. And so I did go to, a 12-step group to deal with codependency as a young woman and try to get over the grief of the divorce. And I really thought that was it. That was my problem, was dealing with other people's issues, right? You know, and I want to speak about my parents in a way that honors their memory because, you know, thank God I don't blame them for anything today. I really don't. I think that, you know, what does the word say? God's going to judge us by our actions. What we do for his kingdom is going to stand. The rest is going to get burned up in the fire. You know, they did what they could for me. That you can't give someone what you don't have. And so I'm not meaning to speak ill of them at all, but the point is that you would know that they would have some issues so that you'd understand that I also believe that, you know, I was the healthy one, but I wasn't. I was an overcoper, and I was an avoider, and I was, I wore a mask a lot to try to seem perfect. And, you know, I had a job that allowed me to hide behind a persona that required me to have sort of a persona. So I was really good at not being who I am for a long time.
The perfectionism game is a horrible one, isn't it? You never win that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's terrible. It's really terrible because, you know, it's a reflection of self-idolatry. One of the things that God is doing for me in my recovery right now is showing me that a big, you know, I think my primary sin has been self-idolatry. And I think that, you know, my early childhood and adolescence and young adulthood set me up for that because I was required to be self-reliant in times when I really shouldn't have been, when I really should have been able to depend on the adults around me. But when you try to behave as if you're God, I mean, that's self-idolatry. That's just what it is. And it comes out in a lot of different ways. And I was really surprised to find it coming out in my eating because I'm at a point in life where, you know, I thought that I was very strong in faith. I thought that I was very well recovered from things. I have a lot of peace. I mean, I made a lot of progress in my relationships with my parents before they died. And so it was kind of, you know, it was kind of surprising to me to realize that I do have this problem.
I love that, Kim. I have always talked about I'm my own God, but the term self-idolatry is really good. And, Bill, you talked a little bit about perfectionism. I think that's what you were trying to say.
That was the word I was trying to spit out.
They kind of do tie in. And Kim, I was thinking, we were talking about my parents before we went on the show. My parents were divorced, too, and I liked how you honored them. I think we do the best we can, but if we don't have God in our lives front and center, and sometimes I choose not to do that, we're unarmed. You know, we don't have the goods to deliver. And so that's a good lesson to learn, and it sounded like you coped by being, I'm going to be the best I can, and I'm kind of perfect, and I got this going. But yet you realized you needed to improve that, and you went to a 12-step meeting. I like that.
Well, yeah, and you know, the very first time I ended up in therapy and in a 12-step meeting as a young adult, I learned about, is it Bowen family theory of alcoholism and about the roles that the children take on and the various roles?
Bowen was one who came up with that. I think he was at the University of Wisconsin and he did the family sculpture, so I think you're correct.
So my thing was, you mean, there were five children and we definitely it's like he had been, you know, eavesdropping in our home. And so my role was that I was the one who was supposed to go out and make the family look good. Mm. So I don't, you know, the hero or whatever. And, to the end, I have a brother. He passed away, in an untimely manner. It was completely crushing. But to the end, he kept insisting that I was some sort of a hero. You know, like you don't understand. You don't understand that none of us were free to be anything with these roles that, you know, the family system required of us. And that's not part of my 12-step recovery, but it was useful information for me to have at the time because, you know, I see that nobody just wakes up one day and decides to be God. I mean, the word says he set eternity in our hearts. We all know we need God. You know, but if we don't have parents that are giving that to us, if we don't have, you know, the means of accessing that truth as young people, you know, this poor coping arises and then it becomes entrenched and pretty soon it's almost, it's part of your identity. It's a false identity and anybody can overcome it because that's Christ's will for us, but it takes some work.
You got the two narcissists in here. We're struggling with self-idolatry. This is a new term for us. We could do our own show on that. I'm wondering how this started to affect your behavior as far as drinking or food or whatever. And what point in your life did you realize, hey, this isn't working for me.
Well, I think that I have known it for a long time. You know, I work from home, which is a fairly new development. I was always out in the workforce, and a lot of things came together a number of years ago where I actually felt obsolete. I felt as though, okay, my career outside the home is over, my parents have passed, my children are launched, I don't know what I'm going to do with the second half of my life because everything that I've spent my life learning how to do, nobody needs for me to do anymore. I don't need to be a daughter. I don't need to be a mommy. You know, it was very crushing. And this is really when the eating problem really began to develop, particularly being at home. It was almost like remember the cartoons where the guy would pretend to be sleepwalking with his hands out in front of him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, I would groove this little path between my work area and my kitchen. Whenever anything got the least bit challenging at my desk, I was up sleepwalking to the kitchen for sugar, looking for sugar. You know, and those comments that you made about the addictive nature of sugar at the opening of the program are, I mean, it's more addictive than cocaine. If you give rats the choice of white sugar or cocaine, they'll take the sugar and again and again and again until, you know, we don't think it's life-threatening, but it is. We just say diabetes, or we say heart disease, or we say cancer. The cancer, there's a huge connection between sugar and cancer. And so, you know, it's a very much of a life-threatening substance for some of us, at least, if not for everyone. But there I was, you know, compelled to just keep going and, you know, pushing that buzzer so I could get my little rat fix in my kitchen, you know? And so I knew that there was a problem, but I guess the crisis point or hitting bottom was when I needed surgery because of arthritis. And in the recovery phase, realized that it wasn't completely because of my issues, but through various circumstances, I needed to go to the hospital for a follow-up because I had a little anemia. They wanted to do a blood test. 15-minute ride, I had not one friend I could call to take me on a 15-minute ride from my home. And so my isolation had become that heavy. And I realized that, you know, I can't do this anymore. I really need to get a life. That's really where the motivation came to finally admit to myself that I had a problem that I could, you know, maybe find a solution for, and maybe I could stop doing that.
You know, you communicate so well that there's a lot of sadness right here in the room about your honesty. Because we've all been there at some point in our life, Bill, where we could say, hey, you know, the fact I don't have anybody to, you know, if you didn't answer the phone, I'd have to take a cab, you know?
Yeah.
But the sadness that happens before the breakthrough is worth it to get the breakthrough. But isn't that sad?
It was, yeah. I mean, it was really sad. And here's the thing, you know, I had to be careful with that because, wow, one of my hallmarks is self-pity. And I remember reading years ago that the opposite of pity is respect. And so I've learned that when any time I start to feel any twinge or impulse towards self-pity, I need to instead begin building self-respect. You know, and of course the way that we do this is to stop gazing at myself in the self-idolatry, turn my eyes to Jesus, you know, and instead of trying to white-knuckle myself out of my hunger, no, fill myself with what would really satisfy me, you know, God's word and worshiping him and being vulnerable enough to pick up the phone and call people and, you know, So it is sad, but it was a good thing that happened because I probably would still be grooving that rut to the kitchen if that hadn't happened to me. And the deal was too, you know, part of the deal was that I was 30 pounds overweight from the sugar, and that's not helpful when you have arthritis, you know, and sugar is inflammatory. And so it wasn't helpful on any score. It was really, really hurting me. It was very detrimental. It was very self-destructive and self-harming behavior. And, you know, so my granny used to say, let her go ahead. You know, when you were doing something really stupid or foolish and she had tried to warn you, she would say, let her go ahead. And I feel almost as though God said, go ahead, Kim. You know, you keep walking to the kitchen. Mm. I'm right here, but you go ahead. You know, and when you're ready, we're going to find another way for you to get through this.
You know, Kim, for the kitchen to be a problem, we got to back up here a little bit and go to the grocery store that equipped the kitchen. That was the problem. So you were at the grocery store thinking, I'm buying this, this, and this. And you probably had some sort of conflict in your head. This is probably not good for me. I shouldn't probably be eating this, but you're still buying it and taking it home. Is that fair?
We're just going to have one.
Okay.
We're just going to have one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
George, you were talking about, you know, we're just going to have one. And then, and I realized when it was really active, I realized one day I had a mouthful and my hand was in the bag and I was thinking more. I hadn't even swallowed it.
I'm with you.
Right? I mean, that is an illness. That is sick. And, you know, I struggled in the beginning because this first step that we admitted we were powerless over food and our lives had become unmanageable, you know, and then as you get through the steps, you hear, you know, that God could restore me to sanity. The next step, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, wait a minute. Am I insane? You know, well, yeah, wait a minute. Are you? You know, and someone was parsing this for me the other day, you know, well, is that a Dodge disease? Rather than saying sin. And the most beautiful thing happened in church today. One of the readings was Isaiah 53. And it's, you know, talked about our transgressions, our iniquities, and the chastisement for it was put on him. And by his stripes, we are
healed.
It doesn't say forgiven. It says we're healed. So is there a difference in God's mind between our sin, sickness, and sin? You know, if our transgressions and iniquities are the problem and God says his answer is we are healed, I just really don't think it matters. And it would really trouble me if anybody listening to this would say, you know, first of all, I don't need that, you know, because I don't have a disease, even if you identify some of these behaviors I'm describing. Or if anybody else listening would say, well, they're giving people the wrong information. It's not a disease. It's sin. It's a sin problem. Well, yes and. Yes and.
This is great. Bill and I talk about this a lot, Kim. And for me, you know, I don't know if it's a disease or not, but I know all disease was caused by the original sin, and that's why we have death and so on and so on. But the focus is on the solution, okay? I know for me as a recovering alcoholic addict that when I pray to God every morning to stay sober through the day and try to work an imperfect program and work 12 steps and go to Bible study and go to church and thank God at night when I remember, because I'm old and I forget, to thank him for the recovery, it works. And so, you know, I think we've medicalized some things too along the way, but apart from God, you know, that sin is missing the mark. And if that turns into a disease, okay. But the solution is Jesus. And I don't want to miss that. And you said that so well. I never want to alienate anybody because our experiences are different, but we do have the same Redeemer.
Mm, all right.
Amen.
On that note, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Kim. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery tonight. So glad you're on board. Back in a minute. Welcome back. We are chatting tonight about eating disorders and how you can develop an addiction to food, and that gets you in trouble. I want to say God is more real than your needs. And George, I love the way that our guest Kim is being so incredibly vulnerable and transparent. It's fascinating.
It's very interesting because we felt the shared emotions there on the last bit that we were talking about. I'm really interested, Kim, once you were aware when you went to the hospital, you have an operation, you go back and you realize there's an issue here. What did you do to start on your journey to change it?
Well, I had picked up in an airport a book called Food Triggers Rona Epstein is the writer.
That's who I was talking about earlier that we had on our show. Oh, yeah, great.
Okay, so I picked this book up because I was doing a lot of traveling. This was maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 months before I started at OA. And I picked this book up because travel is very chaotic for me on eating. And, you know, it's eating for others, but it's also, you know, I think, Bill, you mentioned, well, it's there. I you know, I want to be sociable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like anybody cares that you eat a donut or not.
Right.
But sometimes people do. I fixed you a special cake, you know, whatever.
Right.
But no, you don't have to eat for others. Please, anybody listening who does that, you don't have to. It's okay. You may say, no, thank you. And you don't have to say anything else. You just say, no, thank you. But even on, you know, I was trying to help the flight attendant. Oh, yes, I'll thank you. I'll have, you know, whatever. Anyway, so the eating was very chaotic with travel. So I saw this book. I put it in my bag. And I didn't think about it too much further. And then here I am recovering on the couch after this surgery. And I pulled the book out. And, you know, she said OA. And I had known about OA for years. But, you know, it's so insidious. Well, I'm not anorexic or bulimic, by the way that you described both of those illnesses
mm-hmm.
at the top. And, you know, if someone does fit in that description, I have people who are very close to me in my life who are in that category and who are in recovery. There is recovery possible for that, too. That just didn't fit with me. But I once read that, I don't watch Oprah, but we all have seen her weight go up and down in public. And I once read that she said she thinks she has extended bulimia, which is what happens when you yo-yo diet, right?
Mm.
So you binge and you put on 30 pounds and then you purge with a crash diet, you know? And so, I mean, that was my pattern. It was, I probably lost 300-400 pounds over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, 20 and 30 pounds at a time. You know, but the problem isn't the food and the problem isn't the weight. Although with OA, I can tell you I'm down 20 pounds and I still have some to go, but I am not, I haven't had any sugar to eat for over 7 months.
Wow.
So, you know, we're talking on a very spiritual level and I'm, you know, I'm trying to share my story, but the thing that was so helpful to me in that first meeting, I was given a pamphlet that they have called The Dignity of Choice, and it says, you know, here are some plans of eating. Now, choose one, but you need a plan of eating. And the woman that I had asked to be my sponsor, you know, mentioned her plan, and so I admired her recovery, so I said, that sounds like a good plan. So my plan of abstinence is I don't eat sugar. I don't eat it. And I have 3 meals a day. It's the 3-0-1 plan. 3 meals a day, 0 in between, 1 day at a time.
Mm.
You know, and so that's, so food has really lost its power over me. Now, I can still, you know, be tempted. I can still have a slip where I may eat a little more at one of those meals than I know I really had intended to eat. But I'm no, the floor is all leveled out between my office and the kitchen, you know? That's just not happening. And you're right, I don't bring that stuff home from the grocery store. And I don't have this scarcity mentality that it's in front of me, I must have it. I really have adapted the, you know, the just for today, I'm not having that. You know, for today, no, I want to be abstinent today. And so these are the nuts and bolts tools that have helped me, you know, as you say, get the eating under control. Nobody can stop eating. But this is the way that I have found to be restored to sanity with it.
You know, I love the fact that you're talking about one day at a time. And what a lot of people don't realize is the 12-step programs come out of the Bible. And they've watered it down that the higher power, you know, God as you understand him. That really came from the Oxford group, and that was an early Christian group where they meant how far along you were in your relationship with Jesus. And when you say one day at a time, that comes out of the book of Matthew, Matthew 6:34. Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. Each day has enough trouble of its own. But if we go back to Lamentations in the Old Testament, it says, my mercies are new every morning. And so we do break that down in today. So I like that, you know, 3-0-1 program, Bill.
I do too. It's awesome. And I love the fact that you've had a 7-month freedom from sugar.
Nice.
And you have reprogrammed your thinking to get by without it. So that's amazing because sugar is so powerful.
Did you go through a withdrawal?
You know, I think that because things were happening for me while I was still recovering from a surgery, I did, but it wasn't as difficult as it might have been if that weren't the case. And the other thing that God did that was very merciful for me, it was on an airplane ride, as a matter of fact, was that I saw a movie called That Sugar Film or That Sugar Movie. And he's an Aussie who decided that what he was going to do was switch his diet and for 6 weeks eat the average American consumption of sugar daily, which is, I think, some ridiculous thing like 47 grams or 17 teaspoons. Anyway, and his rules were he couldn't eat desserts or junk. It had to be quote unquote healthy food. And so he had a team of nutritionists and physiologists and kinesiologists and all sorts of people monitoring him. And at some point, you know, about 3 weeks in, when he had already gained 20 pounds, they said, this is really bad. You've got fatty liver disease. He wasn't consuming extra calories. That was one of the things that really, really jumped out at me because, you know, being a diet junkie, I thought I had, you know, I thought I knew the game, what I could get away with. That was my modus operandi. What can I get away with, you know? And so it was like, but after a while, if you damage your metabolism as I had done, you know, your body can't handle sugar in the same way that it would handle healthy foods. And so he was eating the same number of calories, but he was gaining in weight and gaining weight, and he was getting brain fog, and he was getting depressed, and he was getting fatty liver disease, and all of his numbers for everything were crazy. He was pre-diabetic in 6 weeks. And it was like a scared straight experience, you know? I was like, this is not my friend. I had to quit smoking at age 28. I started smoking when I was 13. I think I may have some dopamine issues. I don't know. Anyway, you know, and at 28, I had to say goodbye to my friends, the cigarettes, right? You know, no, it's not your friend. You know, the sugar was my friend. And this movie was like, this is not your friend. This is a lethal enemy. It's poison. And God just gave me this image of anything sugary. I just saw that skull and crossbones like it was rat poison. And so I don't know. I like I say, God was merciful to me. So the initial thing wasn't that. And I just because of where it fell on the calendar, my first OA meeting was on National Candy Day on Halloween.
Perfect like, timing.
It was the first Halloween in a very, very long time when I was not even tempted to have any of the candy. So,
Kim, did you do a lot of your eating privately, or were you also doing it in public among friends? Well, I guess the question I'm trying to get to is, what happens when you are aware of people with an issue, and what can or can't we say to them?
This was part of my crazy thinking. Was yes, I did a lot of my eating in private. But then when it was mealtime, I was going to have a healthy meal. So now you're just eating double calories, right? But somehow that healthy meal was, it's like the joke, what's the joke? If you have chocolate bar with a Diet Coke, they cancel each other out. You know, I quit artificial sweeteners too, by the way. That actually was really important to just restore my taste buds so that fruit tastes really sweet to me now. You know, I don't use artificial sweeteners either, if I can at all avoid that. So, yeah, Bill, I mean, if you know, I don't want to talk about anybody else that I've encountered in OA, but I think that there is a common pattern that eating, you know, is satisfying something else when you're eating. And there's a quiz for OA, just like there is for AA. You know, there are 15 questions you can ask yourself. And the first one is, do I eat when I'm not hungry or not eat when my body needs nourishment? Obviously, the second half of the question is for people who are restricting calories. But, you know, eating when you're not hungry, that's the eating that you're doing alone. Or that might be the eating that you're doing with friends and family when, you know, I just had a huge snack at 4 in the afternoon, but now it's dinner time at 5:30, so let's go ahead and eat. So, yeah, I mean, if people are trying to understand why you're always on a diet and you're not losing weight, or if you have a loved one in that situation, yeah, there's probably, I mean, there's one of the questions is, you know, do I have a stash? Do I have hidden food? Or have I stolen money to buy food? And, you know, I mean, I have heard stories like that in program, you know, or do I eat sensibly in front of others then make up for it when I'm alone? So yeah, the eating patterns are pretty crazy. And there are a lot of us graze. It was just one meal all day long.
Mm.
You know, at the slightest bit of discomfort, go get some food. You know, so it had nothing to do with hunger. And I think too, this is really important. It's not anything that's talked about in OA, but I know this is true for me because I've had kidney issues in the past too. And so I have to be very careful with getting adequate water. I think, you know, a lot of us have a thirst disorder, and sometimes that craving for sugar is masking thirst.
Mm.
And so that's been one thing that's been really helpful, is to be sure that I have, you know, enough water on a daily basis. A lot of us are really thirsty. And if we start thinking about, you know, hungering and thirsting for the good things of God, it's just a picture of what happens to us with this particular addiction.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, Kim. We're going to take one quick break and we'll be right back. We've got more time with Kim. We'll be back in just a minute. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery. Back in a minute. Tonight on Real Recovery, I hope you're enjoying tonight's show. George, I know we are. It's absolutely fascinating discussion with Kim, and she is sharing some of her issues with food, and that is something all of us have to do. We have to deal with it every day, as we are putting food in our mouth, and it's just the portions, and it's the frequency, and it's how we're using food, and it can spiral out of control quickly.
It can, and I think what we see a lot of us do, and a lot of the people we work with, Bill, we can switch addictions. Let's say we get sober, and we talked about the cigarettes, you know, then the smoking goes, and I need some pleasure. I'm not drinking. I'm not smoking. Maybe the food, and I'm thinking, Kim, maybe that part of the indicator that I have a problem is the preoccupation with the thoughts of food. Bill and I were talking over the break. Maybe you heard us. I worry when people invite me over to their house. Number one, is there going to be alcohol in the food? Number two, are they going to have something that I don't eat? You know, number three, and it's like there's a preoccupation even when we get healthy. It's kind of like the band at Chuck E. Cheese. You know, they have that whack-a-mole deal that you hit down when you solve one and then another comes up. So do you think that maybe eating can be the one of the last ones we work on in our life?
Well, I think, yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, again, this isn't 12-step related, but I saw a video, maybe you saw this too, about the guy who discovered the rat park and giving the rats different addictive substances. And then he decided, wait a minute, maybe what the rats behave differently if there were two rats in the maze. And so he said, why don't we make a park for the rats and see if they go to the park together, they could avoid the addictive substances altogether. And sure enough, you know, their conclusion is that the base of all addiction is loneliness. And so I think one of the brilliant things about 12-step recovery is, you know, you're meeting in rooms with people who have the same problem. And it was so lovely for me to walk into that room the first time and to just feel accepted, you know, to just feel as if, you know, and I shared my story, and after the meeting, two people came up and said, well, I'll give you a ride to the doctor. You know, I mean, it was like, all of a sudden I had some friends. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, I have a sponsor who's very strong in program. She lost 70 pounds and has kept it off for, I think, 30 years.
Great.
And she, you know, she says, you know, we were talking about slips and relapse one day, and she said, you know, abstinence is the goal. But, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get there. And if you're at an event and all they have is, you know, food that you don't eat. Maybe it's simple carbs, you know, maybe it's pizza or, you know what I mean? And you have no recourse. Well, okay, you're going to have what you're going to have so you don't starve. And then you're going to get back into your program at your first opportunity. You can give yourself a little bit of grace. I don't feel, you know, and that's happened to me once or twice in, and I know I'm new in recovery, but, again, God, I think, has empowered that grace in those moments, you know, that it didn't turn into a relapse, that it didn't turn into an excuse to, oh, I got away with that. What can I get away with? You know, because that's what the recovery is, you know, regaining a sane way of thinking and a sane way of approaching. And one of the most important things for me has just been able to say, well, you know, if my emotions are out of control in such a way that I'm wanting to eat, you know, what can God do for me? What do I need from Him that I haven't yet gone to Him with? And that's becoming my answer instead of, let me go get something to eat. You know, I even have a God box. I don't know if they use that in AA, but I have a God box. And if it's something really troubling, you know, I can write it down and put it there and leave it in His keeping. And I've had some really sweet answers to prayers doing that. And it's been a great way to put some structure on a very chaotic part of my life.
That's neat. It's an action. Bill, you know, before we go on this thing, let's look back. I've identified the problem that comes from God, but she took action.
Mm-hmm.
She did something. You know, she had a book. She read it. You know, maybe the Holy Spirit sparked her to buy that book before, you know, He knew this was going to happen. No surprises in God's world. And then she takes action and goes to a meeting. That's a big
risk. It's huge. Yeah, it's really a big deal, Kim. And I'm just thinking, this probably happens for everyone with struggling with addiction, is they have this horrible, horrible fear that I'm never going to be able to do X again. I'll never be able to sit down and eat a pint of ice cream again. You know, they have these fears like I can never use again. I can never drink again. And it sounds like there is some balance with you where you understand that if there's a place where you allow yourself grace to have some indulgence, that you're right back into your disciplines the next day.
Well, yeah, and the sugar is the one that's non-negotiable for me, because
okay,
I've learned that there is a physiological thing that happens with me. You know, other simple carbs aren't quite as strong as the sugar, although I understand that they do the same thing, you know, to your system. But, you know, if I have some corn chips, or if I have to have something that has a bun on it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Those are on my list of things that I am abstaining from, but that, you know, that I don't have to. But the sugar is the non-negotiable, because it's not anything you ever need. You don't ever need it. It isn't actually food. Our body doesn't really recognize it as such. And so I'm not giving myself any quarter with that. I'm not talking for anybody else. You know, and there are some people, I guess, just as with alcohol, you know, some people can handle it. So I'm not, please hear me, I'm not preaching against sugar. But what I'm telling you is that I have learned for myself that it's a very dangerous thing, and I can't have it.
But you've been very gentle about it, Kim. You've been speaking only from your perspective and giving us how you feel about it. But you've been very gentle. So thank you for sharing in such a nice way.
Well, and I want to say, too, that, you know, when I read in Rona's book, OA, for, you know, oh, well, I'm not a compulsive overeater. Well, I don't have anorexia or bulimia. You know, maybe I don't need that. You know, except I need something. Why don't I just go and just do what they say? And when I got there, that was my attitude as well. You know, why don't I not be God for a while and take some help? And it was a really good attitude to have. And I'll tell you, every bit of help that I've received in the program is from taking it at face value and taking action as I was instructed to do, from people who have a lot more experience and a lot more recovery than I do. And, you know, if you can open yourself up to that, I think that is somehow creates a space where God comes in and transforms us.
Well, Kim, I know you don't know a lot about radio, but we're coming up on what we call a hard break, where the show is going to end. So we're going to have to wrap things up here pretty quick. But this has been absolutely a fascinating hour, George.
It's been great. And the self-idolatry, I'm going to steal from you and use that term because
it's
that
brilliant.
Really, really hit home for me. Thanks, Kim.
Yeah.
I want to hear more, George, on your thoughts about addiction as a worship disorder.
Well, for me, real quick, and I don't know how much time I have, but I think all it is we're trying to get something that we can only get from God. And I would go to Tim Keller on this, that the false gods. And so I'm really worshiping myself to try to make myself feel better. Interestingly enough, when you get into recovery, the thing that really lights me up more than anybody is telling people what Jesus has done in my life and sharing that.
Amen.
All right, Kim, thank you so much for being a guest on Real Recovery. If you want to hear more, you can pass this program on. Go to myfaithradio.com. Go to Real Recovery. Send it out to your friends. Thanks so much for listening tonight. We hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great week, everybody. Good night. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.